Hello there, ladies and gentlemen. Those who live in a castle and those like Ian who live in a cardboard box. My name is Jared. My co-host is Ian. And with me today, the wonderful duo from Grodd Games, Catherine and Devin. Say hello, everybody.
Hey, everyone. We're excited to be here.
Hello.
So yesterday we discussed this wonderful game of Estate Raise the Realm, and today we're going to peek behind the curtain as we discuss what all goes into making a game like this, and maybe learn a little bit about the faces who made this game come to life. So join us at the table as we discuss. All right. Ian, do you want to jump in? Get us started?
No, you're doing such a good job. I'm just gonna be present in the moment.
On a podcast is perfect.
No. I want to be in the realm. I'm going to be in my own realm and enjoy the moment as it is.
Awesome. Thank you for that. All right. Well, I'll be happy to jump in then. So we'll open the floor, guys. For those who have not met you yet, who are Devin and Catherine?
Yeah, we are a husband-wife team. We actually were high school sweethearts, so we've known each other quite a long time. We kind of rediscovered a love of board games together during college with some friends who introduced us, or I would say reintroduced us to the hobby, and then dove off the deep end during the pandemic when we were all going crazy and Devin had a crazy idea to make our own game. So that's kind of how Grodd Games got started, in a tiny little Boston apartment. And between now and then, we've done a ton of traveling around the U.S., connecting with players, going to a bunch of conventions, and bringing our first game to life, which was a super big milestone for us this January, when we released Estate Raise the Realm. And we're still working on more titles, and so we're excited to kind of be trying to grow Grodd Games beyond just one game. But right now, yeah, Estate Raise the Realm is out in the wild. And we have a small but mighty team of partners that we work with, but we are a very indie studio. So the core team is really Devin and myself, but we've got a great artist we work with pretty consistently and a slew of other folks as well on our network.
If I was to add a little context to what Catherine shared, you know, 2020 game was designed and then we just kind of put it on a shelf for 2 years. And then Catherine kind of alluded to it. In 2022, we did a year-long road trip, and there was a lot of time for me to be probably passenger prince. You may see some Instagram content around that. But while I was the prince, I was, you know, busy iterating on card design and having fun with game design. And then obviously we're bringing the game to all these different locations and playtesting at lots of shops.
Yeah, how do you feel about that? Because, I mean, a lot of games don't go through that whole process of almost having, like, this year-long or year-plus-long, like, I don't know, you know, preview or some type of, you know, media marketing adventure. How was that experience? Was it long? Did it feel long? Or you're like, I'm ready for it to come out? Or how did that whole process feel?
Yeah, I would say, like, taking a step back, we were playtesting for quite a while, and then we were on Kickstarter in 2024, kind of at the end of the year, so October, November. And then it was a very long journey for us on this, like, kind of on the inside of, like, putting the bow on it. And it feels like one of those things where it's, like, never done until it's done, right? Until you actually hit go on manufacturing. But
there's always one more thing.
Yeah.
Always one more thing we can do.
But it was pretty incredible to just kind of continue iterating on it even after the Kickstarter. And, like, we had a much bigger community after that of people who either had already backed the game or who we were meeting and then were, you know, interested in kind of late pledging and, like, continuing to provide us feedback and all really great insights, many of which we incorporated. And we already have kind of a list of things that, you know, now that it's been released and we've got a bunch of players playing it, like, we're getting even more feedback of, like, what could be improved, maybe, like, the rule book and that kind of stuff. So it's never done, but it's fun to really just have it actually be out in the wild. And it's been such an incredible experience and feeling just to, like, get all these photos or just, like, random pictures on Instagram we're getting tagged on of, like, someone getting the game that, like, isn't someone know anymore, right? It's, like, grown bigger than just our, like, you know, peripheral circle of people that we know.
No more friends sending us a text photo.
Absolutely.
That's awesome. Very cool. So Devin, I'm curious, Can you pronounce your last name for me?
If I was to like Americanize it, it'd probably be like Grodkiewicz. I can try doing it in Polish. It's like Grodkiewicz, but I suspect I'm mispronouncing it. So Grod from Grodkiewicz, root of Grod Games. We didn't know this until like, I just want to say like June of last year. We were at a wedding. Okay. And someone there was Polish, and we were just chatting about names. And they were like, you know, your last name means of the castle, which like I had not heard that before. And then I had to go look it up. And basically like Grod, or, you know, there's a slight, you know, I think, you know, going through the immigration process, there was a slight change to the last name there. But that Grod phrase is like a fortified settlement or castle. So unintentionally, we made our publishing business Castle Games. And we designed a first game with a little castle tower in it, too, which made me laugh.
That's really cool. I mean, I was really curious where in the process you guys were like, okay, this has to be the name. And to hear the story behind it and what it means, that's just such a cool fit. I really love that. So, okay, we've talked about in COVID and a little bit before that, we're kind of getting back into our love of board gaming. And like, was that with 2020 and then shelving it, and then 2022 and kind of continuing that process, where in that span did you two look at each other and say, we don't want to just play games, we need to make games? Like, where was that transition?
You know, I think I'd always had a slight desire to get into game design. Mm-hmm. And had you know, basically a housemate of mine that was very close that helped bring us back into the gaming community. You know, back in middle school, I remember being like, ooh, Axis and Allies, what's that? And that's kind of what I was playing back in the day. And then going into college, obviously we were playing these games, and his brother was probably foundational in making the leap from, I kind of want to make a game, to I will make a game, where with them, you know, we have this annual tradition of playing Scythe, and this is at PAX Unplugged. And after the game, was just chatting through it, and he was like, you should make a game. And so I was like, you know what? I will. And that friend was very motivating. Unfortunately, he did pass away due to competition with Marfans. So then it kind of became like in his spirit a little bit of pushing it forward. And actually, you'll see in the back of our rule book, there's a note about that where we talk a little bit about that. And, you know, a portion of the games, basically like the profits of the game, are going to the Marfan Foundation. It's not something we talk about a lot because we're not trying to make it the center. But really, he was kind of inspirational for it, where he kept motivating me. He was one of our early play testers, too. There used to be a lot of take that in the game, which I'm sure if you've both played it now, you'll see it's very take that light. You know, there's a little bit, a pinch. And that came about from his play testing, where we had some very aggressive, like, pirate ships and raiders, and there was all these things happening, and like, it's like, this feels bad, this moment right here, and let me tell you why. So he was also pivotal in that early playtesting phase.
That's really cool. No, I think that's an exceptional way to you know, pay honor in that that process. And you know, as we play games, we're always looking for those experiences. And I think that's really cool that there's an experience before this game was ever even made with y'all, that, you know, there's this hidden, you know, story behind it. I think that's really cool. I think it's a really cool backstory to how you got to the point of designing, getting that that confidence to go out there and design. And I think that's a really good thing to look at in any game design. Is I always wonder what made you know, get to the point to say, hey, I'm just gonna do it. And so I guess my question in all of that is, like, from that process of kind of getting that encouragement in that way, you know, what was your first step? What was, like, did you already have that game design in your head? Or what was that first, like, that first game mechanic or game theme or whatever? What was that first thing that kind of came from that conversation that you were having?
The game was meant to be a love letter. So you'll see a lot of inspiration from a variety of games that Catherine and I love. And you can list them off.
Well, like, I think if you look at our gaming collection, there's like a genre of game that we just like to play. So I would say sweet spot of like a medium weight, sometimes heavier weight strategy game that has like worker placement, engine building, some of those kind of core mechanics. And so kind of like during COVID, we had sort of played our whole collection. And then we were like, let's start pulling our favorite elements from all these games. And I always like to describe it to people like that analogy that they used in Trek of like, it's like an onion and you're peeling back the layers. Like, the first
That's
version.
A great analogy. That's so good. I love that.
I think that like you can kind of approach game design in two ways. You can like start with a very core thing and build up, or you can take a lot of stuff and like see what works. And I think that latter was kind of how we approached it, where like we knew there was these things that we like in games. Let's try to take as many of them as possible and put them together. But then as we are playtesting, like peeling back the layers of like, you know, Devin is a huge diplomacy guy. You know, so like one of the first versions of the game had a more element of like politics and like voting, and like that ultimately ended up being these air events that happen. So they impact the but they were originally like things you were voting on to enact the policy. And as we kind of narrowed down on like the genre and actual game experience we wanted, we were looking to build a very approachable medium weight game. Something that is not going to scare someone when you are putting it out on the table. It's not going to be like a 5-hour game. It's going to be something that you can play with your friends. Like you know, it's going to be like a 1 to 2 hour experience, like with your gaming group, but also like, let's say you have someone who's only experienced with games or like, you know, Code Names or like these other more like lighter weight mass market family style games, but they're intrigued by maybe a more heavier game. Like you could like introduce them to this style of medium weight games with Estate. And so as we are playtesting, we are trying to very narrow down on a focus of like, what's causing the dopamine hits, you know? Where is it feeling like a little bit like too crunchy, where like, you know, some players love the crunchiness, but like that wasn't. Sure. I think that like, as we talk about our catalog of games we're trying to build, there's going to be another game that's like a little bit heavier and crunchier. And then there's going to be other games we want to build that are even like, you know, more approachable, lightweight than Estate, Raise the Realm. But I think like knowing your audience and the kind of game you want is very important in the game design process, because, you know, if you try to do too much, like none of it works well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's, you know, finding your target audience, especially within the game itself, is a really, yes, like you said, that is such something that needs to be utilized when designing. So as far as the theme, where, you know, we're talking about rebuilding, you know, your noble house in a great war. Is that coming from that politics of potentially the diplomacy and these other aspects of the games that the theme came out in this, or where did it kind of settle in on that theme?
I feel like I have a distinct memory of Devin read this book about Polish history and how it's like the one of the first modern day democracy systems where there's not necessarily like a blood lineage for how the monarchs were, you know, inheriting the title. Yeah. And so you read like this book and then like, you
I think
know,
it was just called Poland.
Wow.
Basically history fiction, like fiction within history. And he follows a progression of families through like early Poland up until the modern day, like basically like 1900s. And and there's one section that highlights the medieval period. And there was this term called Golden Liberty, which that was actually a name for the early prototype. And that was like, it had the elements of Twilight Imperium, the elements of diplomacy.
Too much.
Loved in one game. And I was like, this is too much.
Yeah. But yeah, I feel like as we think about like also like why we wanted to publish versus kind of licensing is like, we wanted to kind of control this IP of the Estate universe and this narrative and story that we're telling. And so this game, Raise the Realm, as you're raising your realm after the war happens lore wise. And we're also going to be like dropping more of this along the year. And like, as we get ready for our next game, but like the big picture is that this war breaks out because like that whole voting and democracy of the monarchs, like that all like went haywire and like people got upset and like the nobles start clashing, and that's what the war is. And then so like now after the war, like there's been this trade queen who's been elected the queen of the land, and then like all these noble houses, some of them are net new, some of them have been existing, and like there's actually a really big map that we're working on right now with our artist James. We're very excited that. And that is going to depict like the state of the world as we go into game, like Estate Raise the Realm. We're also going to have a map for like, how did it look before the war? And that's actually a key component of our next game, Estate the Great War, or we're thinking about maybe calling it The Realm Wars. We're still kind of working on the title there, but
nice.
Yeah, so like you're kind of a question of like, where did the theme and narrative come? Like, I think that a lot, like as with most games, it's like you're trying to like have an experience at the table. Mm-hmm. And so, like, these characters we've designed, like, it's kind of like this gateway to this world that we're trying to build in. And our vision as a publishing company is to really build bespoke games within the world with maybe like these different types of mechanics. So like you have an option to play different style games, but all within the world of Estate based on who you're playing with and, you know, the kind of game night you want to have.
Man, that's so cool. Yeah, that's
I love it.
Yeah, awesome. Awesome.
I came home from TantrumCon and I was like, Ian, I have a new publisher that I'm rooting for, man. Because
he did.
They cast the vision and I was like, ooh, I'm on board. So that's really exciting. It really is to think about this almost multiverse or in-universe, you know, cinematic universe of sorts for board gaming. And you have that with specific IPs, but I don't know how often we've seen that on its own. And I just think that's really exciting that one, you have a vision for several different games already, but two, to take these games that you're basically creating a love letter to and having the self-awareness of how do we take aspects of that, but still keeping it in a way that's approachable for a lot of people. And that's been part of our experience, as I've shared it at the table, is it is very accessible. And there's a lot of people that are like, I can do this. I mean, most worker placement games, I feel like I'm spending so much time going through all the different things that you can do that they glaze over by the time we get to gaming. But here, they jump right in. And so kudos to you guys for that, because just thinking about what we've talked about so far, I'm so on board.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that universe, like you're saying here, this thematic world that you're creating, one, I love theme so much. Like I'll play really any game if I know the theme is there. And especially if I like the idea of the theme, I'll play anything. And this idea that you are really this world that you're creating, I mean, I love it too. I think it's a fantastic idea. And I absolutely adore this idea of having multiple games within that world. And I think that's such a neat idea. And so I think it's just a fantastic way to approach gaming. And I think that kind of freshness in this game, in this hobby, is awesome. So you guys, really good work there.
So let's jump into the nitty gritty a little bit. We mentioned the rounds with the different eras and the way that they have both, you know, it basically gives players something to work for with a discount and an end goal by the end of the round. But then you also have personal goals that are ongoing throughout the game. Did you find in playtesting that was difficult to find balance there? Because I know you've got positive and negative era effects, and then you've got a wide range of different objectives that don't necessarily have to coincide with what the noble is trying to do, but there's still that, you know, you want things to flow with your engine. So can you walk us through that process a little bit?
I think the error events and also the scoring in particular of like how we score the error events were some of the trickiest aspects of the game. I don't know if you want to dive too much into that, but we had like an early version where it used to be, you know, a card that you could acquire. So if you took first, you would acquire the card and it was worth points. You know, then you have a tie and then people are placing cubes on it. So we used to have like markings on the card. And then it was a question of how do you split the points. And then there was this element where once someone acquired enough error event cards, they were typically snowballing and sort of running away with the game. So we had to find a way to insert a very light catch-up mechanic. And you'll see that in scoring now, where the scoring used to just be points. And I think that was one of the biggest methods that we used to help balance the error events in terms of the power of acquiring them and taking first. Mm-hmm. an incentive in the first like one or two eras to fall back to second and get that card and a resource, because early game, that extra card and a resource in second is very valuable.
I think also the other aspect is like something we really like in games is replayability. And so that was like, I don't want to say it's easy because it wasn't easy, but like that's like a key element that adds the replayability of the game and the variance. And so for sure, like there's certain synergies with certain air events and certain leaders where like, you know, if you have the air event that needs tucked cards and you're the warlord and like that comes out era one, like it's kind of like, okay, like they might do that. But I also think that like that is, you know, just like as you play the game more, like you know what more options could be. And I think that that's another variance too in like a two player versus a, you know, five player is you might have more people tying for events in like the 4 to 5 player game. The two player, like it's way more important that you're getting a couple of those wins because
absolutely.
If that one player just wins all of them, like Devin said, it's kind of a snowball effect.
Yeah.
Jared, you mentioned the private objectives or the family secrets. Those were actually meant from an accessibility standpoint, where a lot of players, the first time playing, they get overwhelmed by the cards because there's a lot of cards in the game. It's got that, you know, it's not quite the same issue as Terraforming Mars, because Terraforming Mars, every card in the deck is unique. there are duplicates in our deck. But the family secret was really designed to root new players so that they have something like, okay, I need to go for this because this will get me some extra points at the end of the game. And so it gives them a little bit of focus early on.
I really enjoyed playing. Yeah, for the first time, like, I mean, I love worker placement games and card games. Like the combination of those is great. And I think having that accessibility, like you're saying, I noticed kind of from the get-go, because, you know, you're looking at, you know, the first round and what that era is, you know, you're trying to go for, but then also you have these hidden things that you're trying to slowly collect and build up for. And I think that vision as a player, just it does make it super easy to kind of get into. And I think that's a really good, nice feature of really just starting out from the jump, knowing, having a direction. And especially when we get into the player abilities as well, you are just given as a new player, even if you haven't played a ton of games, I've been able to just tell, hey, this is what you do. This is what you do well. Here's some hidden objectives. They can just walk in and find their way throughout the game. Was that something that you really wanted to target when designing? Because again, we talked about kind of this family like game. Was that something that was really, you just really wanted to focus on when designing?
I feel like it organically happened for this game, but it's something we're heavily thinking about as we design more games, because we were actually at Gamma Expo and I forget who told us this, but it's like a stat where it's like most games, like 60% of the players who play them will never play it again. And that's not necessarily because it's like a bad game. It's just like there's so many games out there. So you really want to think about the first time someone's playing a game and making that really strong impression, but also making it very approachable to learn. And that's something that I think we ended up doing decently well in this game. But
absolutely.
Trying to like have that be like one of our design principles is like, what does that first time play experience feel like? But then also, how do you make it like you just want to play it again and again and again?
Yeah.
I think that's where like the asymmetry of our leaders really lends itself of like, you know, you could have the exact same air event set up, but play as a different leader and it could be totally different for you. And just like, those are just different design principles that are kind of like core for us at the, like, as we're thinking about more design.
I think those are incredibly valuable to look at when you're designing. I think that's, when I pick up a game, like you're saying, and I feel like I play a lot of games, but then, you know, I look at all the games that come out per year and I haven't played any of them. But when I feel like I do play a lot of games, and yeah, like you said, that I didn't even know that statistic. That is wild. If that, is just so crazy.
Yeah. I don't know if it's true.
Yeah, no, I mean, even if it's.
We don't want this to be true.
Yeah, I mean, even if it's anywhere near that number, that's still crazy. And so, like you said, like, and I think it's true for myself, if I don't have even like an okay experience playing a game for the first time, it does kind of leave a bad taste in your mouth. And you know, oftentimes I won't necessarily come back to that game. And so at least having an experience that, you know, is welcoming, that you can kind of hop into or at least pick up quickly, is important. And I did feel that when playing this game. So I think that was a very smart design choice when designing. And I think moving forward, that is something that gamers do want. I think that's important.
So something else we found in this same vein is not only, you know, getting into the game, but then the flow. And you guys have found a nice flow in a simple four action choice, basically system with your workers. I imagine there was a lot of fine tuning to get down to that, as you've talked about whittling down things from different games to get that streamlined system. Was it always four actions, or was it other options as well as you kind of went through the process?
I think we might have started with like five workers, and in play testing, I think what used to be you could acquire up to like eight workers, whereas now it's six. So there was a lot of playing around with that worker count to try to optimize the number of turns each player could take.
And I think that also comes down to like how long we wanted the game to be. Like, we were trying to really make a 2 hour or less game at all player counts.
Yeah.
And I personally like that it's like, you know, you go through the five rounds, five eras, and then you're done. It's not like someone's going to end the game early on you, or it's like, I see an E on that water bottle. but I feel like this always happens to me in Scythe, like more times than not, where it's like, I'm just getting going, and then someone gets star and the game ends.
Right. How did, because I definitely, you know, one thing I do love, one about this game is that, you know, you have those kind of four actions to start the game, and you kind of get a feeling, and then like you're saying, it kind of does pick up. You know, how was, you know, you said all the way up to eight to four. When did you decide, you know what, this is the perfect amount of workers, or this is the perfect amount of rounds that you kind of get, you know, you feel kind of complete? Because like you said, I felt like I had a complete game when it ended. That was, I mean, what was that process to like fit that just the perfect amount of rounds versus workers and all that?
I'm having a hard time remembering. Yeah. Like, I just feel like we got to like this version, like that core kind of set of like constraints, if you will, of like, this is what we want that to be. I feel like that was like in like 2023, 2024, like, or like, well, sorry, definitely 2023. And then a lot of what we were fiddling around with was like the scaling on the leader tracks, or what air events were, or like what the cards themselves and those effects, and like the resource balancing. You did a lot of work on like, you know, what the cost of a card was versus the victory point value. So it was more of that. I feel like it kind of came together of like, these are the four actions that you can choose to take. And I don't remember when it became five arrows.
Fifth action. But then just as a note as well, you found a really interesting mechanic change. So it used to be when you would play a production card, which is, you know, primarily production cards, that's your engine building component of the game. All of them give you resources. And it used to be when you played those, you would resolve the effect immediately.
Mm. Okay.
The higher worker count, it just like, it made it like
the game longer.
Made the game longer, where every time you're playing a card, you're having this effect get resolved. So there were, that was like a minor tweak that, yes, when you play a card, you're no longer getting that dopamine of something happening immediately. Yeah, I get a little bit because you remove a cube from your tableau. Mm-hmm. But having that not have that effect sped the game up dramatically. And then it was like, well, maybe, you know, could we also like cut down the workers? And then we started like fooling around more with those things. And then cutting down the workers meant lowering resource costs. So there's all that element that you were kind of speaking to earlier.
Absolutely.
I love it.
Go ahead.
So,
Dave.
Okay. Well, while we're here in this picking apart why we did what, a very consistent, I've been trained by others in the industry to just ask the designer, because you have an answer why you did this usually. The consistent comment I would get at the table when I would show this to new people is they would say, I wish there was more cards in the market. Like, I'm like, well, I don't know. I kind of feel like four gives you enough, but then I also get the other side of it of like, if you start to get stuck looking for a specific suit, or if you're looking for a specific combo, then four might feel very limiting. So as the designer, how did four become the final decision?
We fooled around a lot with the card spread, and that was something that was tricky. Like, I think at one point it was like the size of the Everdell Meadow.
Yeah, which I think it's 8. Out. Yeah.
Wow.
So I was going to say, like, that was definitely something we were very considerate of. And I do think that it's a balance, because like drawing is an action and you want people to be devised to build that up, so they're drawing more than one. But that was the intentionality around like every era when you reset, you refill the market. That was so that you see more cards there. The draft is also very intentional, where like you can see all the cards up front and then like be building your hand. And then, I think that like just like there's a little bit of that chance of like, are you going to get the cards you need?
Go ahead. At 8 cards, which was like one of our early versions of that, you know, Meadow equivalent. We originally didn't have that. It was just the deck. And there's like, let's add this in and we'll start with 8 cards. That was 1% of the deck.
Yeah.
So odds were really good that you were going to see a card that you would want to draw.
It was almost like too easy. It was too easy. And it was also like people during playtesting, it was almost like analysis paralysis too much, right? Of like you're seeing too many things in front of you and you'd like maybe like have too many options. So
yeah.
We dropped that down to 6 and then tested it for a bit. And then we brought it down to 4 and 4 felt right.
Yeah. Okay. The other aspect of that, just like as a side note, is table space. So as you get more cards out, like you need a bigger board. Just like we were trying to be mindful of like you can try hopefully fit this game on a lot of different size tables.
And while we're on it, since we're talking about design, there was an early version as well where we didn't have, before Air Events, there was another version, and that was the Agricola style. We're going to flip over new gather actions and new resource actions. That at that point, there was like, that's when we dropped the worker count to 4, and then we had like 12 rounds. It was a long game.
Yeah.
You were revealing all these various gather actions. And I ended up taking a lot of those actions and incorporating those into the gather cards that you see now.
Yeah, that's a really nice, that was a nice change for sure. I think that for what this game wants to be, I think any of those gathering actions and any of those, I think the balance there is really cool. One, that you can change them out, but just that there's always this constant change on the board that you can see. Okay, well, like I want to go, you know, I want these resources normally, but what do these special actions do? And as I get more advanced in that action, I get to do the stronger ones. I think it's a really nice feature. And I think that's a really good point you said, is that it was almost too easy to get the cards you want. So when I'm playing the game, I want it to be a little easier, but I totally respect why, I think you do want to, a little bit more difficult. And I think that kind of plays into, as far as the final scoring too, like you have 8 different categories of scoring, was that part of that process too, of like, how did you come up with those 8 categories? And then within that, like the card count, different cards, how often you see specific cards, how did that all tie into this too?
I think his brain.
A lot of questions, all in one question.
Yeah.
Well, I think the philosophy. So
your final scoring in with the different categories. What determined how you were going to pick those categories, and what was the layout that you finally settled in on?
I would say like the philosophy behind having so many is that we wanted there to be a lot of options of strategy. Mm-hmm. And not have it be pigeonholed. I also personally, as a player, I like scoring at the end of games, because anytime you're tracking during a game, I always forget to do it at some point. And then, and I also think there's like a little bit of an element of surprise. Like I kind of like that, of like not necessarily knowing how well someone's, little side thing is doing. Like it's just kind of
exactly.
But how you landed on all those categories, I have no idea.
Yeah. There's a handful of core victory point conditions that like they make up the bulk of your points. and that, you know, playing cards into your estate, that's going to be, usually it's about 40% of your points. And then that's like, that's the majority right there. And then the other seven make up that remaining 60%. So that's where you get these really interesting, like, ooh, I'm going to go all in on the tucking and gold strategy. So you're balanced out by these three things. And I've seen people get like, you know, 40, 50 points from gold sometimes.
Wow.
So there is that unique, to Catherine's point, I'm going to go all in on this. Like one time I went all in on the farm and farmer strategy, where I had five farms and three, I got every farmer in the deck. And that was, I got those out early and I was just collecting gold from my farmers on the farms. And at the end of the game, you get extra victory points for farms. It was beautiful. I lost by 2 points and it was a loss for me, where I was like, I am all in on the theme. I am the agrarian lord and I'm going on the strategy for fun just to see how it turned out. So I play that now sometimes. Normally I'm a very competitive player. I always want to win. But I've gotten to the point, the state where I'm going to go for this theme route and just see what happens. And you end up with some like really interesting victory point scenarios.
Yeah.
I almost won that. And like, I was going for this theme route. I was like, well,
I will say,
Go ahead.
I was going to say, like, I feel like one of our, like, when we say like our key inspirations, we say it's like Everdell, Wingspan, and Agricola. And like, you look at how those games score, there's a lot of similarities. One of the biggest differences, though, between us and Agricola is that in Agricola, it is a very harsh game. Like, if you don't do something, you get negative points. And we wanted to really flip that and have this be like, this is like a maximizing game. Like, you're just trying to do all the fun, cool things you can do and spread out the points potentially that way. But like, you're not like penalized if you don't have a tucked card at the end of the game.
Or you took the only spot that had read.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, there's always like, generally, if you're creative about it, like there's always a way to do what you want. It's maybe the best strategy for you, but it's just like, you can be really creative and get a lot of interesting combos done.
How is the, because I'm like super competitive too. So how is it that when you're, you know, designing a game, you're like, man, I really want to win, but I really need to test this for the game. So how difficult is it to choose that over winning?
I mean, there's a handful of playtesters who consistently, like, they just have that like mental model of a brain where they can just like memorize the cards, and I'm very grateful that they played it, and
they would beat him all the time.
Like every
Yeah, pretty much. There's a couple cards in the game that say, you know, once an era they can activate, and that's generally because it's powerful, and that's generally because our playtester Alex broke the game with it. But like Devin said, like, those types of people are invaluable in the playtest.
Absolutely.
Because everyone's brain works differently. So you obviously like need to have different people playing, but then to have someone who can just, you know, he would just like look through the deck. Like, he would, there'd be months between when we'd see him, right? Cause we actually were just going to conventions and he happened to be going to these same conventions, and he would remember like an old rule and be like, oh, you changed this.
He'd be like, you changed this.
Like, why'd you do that? And it was just like, that was like such a thing, just like, you know, partnership in a way of like having who consistently played the game, different versions of it, and kind of giving us that iterative feedback.
Man, that's so cool. Yeah, that's invaluable. That's awesome. We always wonder who the playtesters are within games. And I think that's such a cool story of having this individual that is really just, it just sunk into that game design, like from start to finish.
Yep. So I want to give props to what you said earlier about having the ability to be flexible when you get into the game. I remember a game we played a little bit ago. My assassin was taken out in era two by the most wretched era card. I hate it so much. The one that kills a civilian. So my warlord was abandoned very early, and I was like, I don't know what to do right now. But then it was I don't want to say it was easy, but you almost kind of take a step back and you look at what the game has given you and you can pivot your strategy. And so even losing an ability, losing a primary card, that was something for me that we got to see late in the review process that I thought was just so cool. And I think I mentioned it yesterday on the review, but it's just so cool to be able to see a game that allows that flexibility where, yeah, I'm going to give you something, but it's not the be all end all. That card has ruined me before, by the way. It is multiple times taken out something significant.
Okay. So I've done the math. There is a 90% of your games in a state that will not show up in Era 2. 10% of your games.
Yeah.
And that is my least favorite 10%.
But I think, like, as you become a seasoned player, like, you know what the possibilities could be. And so, like, that's part of your, you know, early game strategy is, like, you get an actor out. So that way, if the plague happens, it's, like, a little bit inconsequential for you. I have to say that when we typically do demos, we typically don't put the plague in because it is
That makes sense. Yeah. It's brutal.
Yeah. It happens in 10% of games as a whole, but it happens in 99% of Jared's games.
It has happened a lot. I agree with you. Go ahead, Devin.
Yes, specifically the plague in Era 2.
Yeah.
And, you know, having the plague in another era beyond Era 2, that's more than 10%.
Sure. Well, and it was interesting because this is going to kind of segue into my next question. We had an experience early on where the plague got my knight. And I thought I lost all the tucked cards that go underneath it. And so this was like with some of the other combos I had going, it was like a 10-point loss or something like that. I've seen you very active on BGG talking through different rules or things that might be in the appendix that is included and some things that still need to be refined and added. Does that, when you get to that stage where your game is published and people are still catching those minor things, is it encouraging because you got players digging into your game? Is it almost nerve-wracking because you're trying to think through all the different things you need to adjust for the next print? What's that emotional state behind seeing those things pop up on the forums?
The first few, I was like, oh no, Catherine.
Yeah.
I think that like it kind of goes back to everyone's brains work a little different sometimes, you know? So like you can't like have it be 100% perfect either. I think that's like another reality of life. So like we're kind of taking it on as like making sure we're listening and aggregating that feedback. And, you know, next time we do a print run, we're absolutely updating the rule book for sure.
Yeah.
Also, as an indie publisher, first time we were making a game, like we had to do a lot of it ourselves. And there's some fantastic people who are amazing at making rule books that can probably do it like 100% better than what we could have done, right? But we did the rule book ourselves and we did work with, you know, a copy editor and they were tremendous in terms of giving us feedback. But I think that having someone who maybe is like a little bit more experienced in writing rule books, like would have done a better job. But at the end of the day, I think that we also designed this game where, like, you like to say it's rules light. It's not necessarily rules light, but, like, it's, like, when you're sitting at the table and, like, you have a question about, like, how it works, like, you can also just kind of infer, like, do what the house rules it in that moment. Like, it's not, like, it needs to be rigid. Like, there's certain rigidity of, like, the game plays a certain way, but we also wanted it just to be, like, a fun experience so that way, like, if a question pops up and that like you guys can all decide at the table, like this is how we want to do it.
And then, you know, there's that scenario where using the hand limit as an example, there's no hand limit in Estate. And I didn't put that in the rule book. It is in the appendix because I just kept getting that question like, is there a hand limit? And I'm like, oh no, there's no hand limit. And that's like to the rules light concept where originally it wasn't in the book because it was just, if it's not in the rule book, it's you should like, well, there's no hand limit then, right? That was my line. And then we're giving me feedback. We're like, this needs to be somewhere.
Yeah.
So we put it in the appendix, which is included with the game.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you're always going to miss some questions. And it's just been fantastic to see people come in. And to your point about the tucked cards, that's a great example of one that I would love to add in. And I have seen it on BGG. And then I will also add, going back to design, there used to be an early version of the player mat that had a little tucked cards depot for this.
Okay.
Where you just tuck all your cards into one stack. But to downsize the player mat a little bit, we got rid of that and borrowed from Wingspan. And that's why when you lose the top, you know, the knight already did their work. They did the service to the, so thematically, you need to keep those cards somewhere. So that's why I've answered that one the way it is.
Yeah.
For sure. No, and I love the theme behind it. And I will say this too. One of the things that I say at the table when I get gamers who are really like, they're really in the hobby, they know what they're looking at. I'm like, guys, I want you to try this game with an open mind, because you're going to find minor things that you're going to see like, oh, this is an indie publisher. But you two did a great job of going through a thorough process of making sure it was nothing that directly impacted gameplay. It's all very niche things I could play that and not at any point have any concerns about a rule or anything like that. So, because most of it's very intuitive.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, that want to sit and you read through the rules, you start playing things, like you said, just start making sense. And if, you know, there was multiple questions that did come up in games that we were playing, but then you kind of just sit there and think through it. You're like, oh, that makes sense with the rest of the game. I was going to ask, with all these, you know, with things that come up after, because again, we're talking about gamers and they overanalyze like every little detail. And so they find like new things within games all the time. Was there anything that surprised you or like your favorite, like either new combo that you'd like never seen before? Anything like pop out of your head? Like, oh, wow, never seen that before. That's pretty cool.
Oh, man. There's two, but I'm trying to remember the second one. But like definitely the first one is we have play tested this so much, played like hundreds of games. Never had someone play and get all their cubes off until the very first convention this calendar year, first weekend of like the release of the game. And I'm telling you, people, oh, you know, most people get one, maybe two of those rows fully removed. No one's ever done all four or all three. And then person did it.
Came to the booth and was like, challenge accepted. I hear you. Move all of my cubes.
Yeah. So
first game he plays, he removes all of the cubes.
That was Mason. Wow. Funniest thing was that he didn't even win the game because he was so focused on optimizing to get the cards out, because it's really hard to get 21 cards played. And so like he lost by 2 points because like someone else was doing something else that like just had gotten like a really big point, you know, accrual.
Yeah,
I feel like there's like some of my favorite combos are just like when you can play a card that lets you play another card that lets you play another card. And like there's like too many variations of like that can happen there, but like that's my favorite when we're playing with especially newer players and they get one of those and they're like, whoa, this is so cool. Like I just like that's for me like the most enjoyable moment when I see someone have that clicking moment.
There's a handful of like interesting scenarios where it's always enjoyable to see how players engage with that scenario. So like one of the air events allows you to basically take a card action twice. And you know, I've seen people use the scout. So they're basically getting two cards drawn. They get four and they get to keep two of them. But probably one of my favorite ones that I hadn't seen yet, I think you saw in an early demo. Someone played the Royal Wood, which is a card where you have two options when you activate it. You can either put wood onto the card or basically send out, you know, a royal decree to the Royal Wood and take wood off of it. But you can't, that's the only card that stores resources on it that you can't use free will, where like granary, lumberyard, you can take resources off that as you need if you'd like to. And some pulled up on that and I was like, oh, like that's pretty cool. You
put it on and took it off.
Take it off. Yep. Wow.
That's awesome.
Small story. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. I can only imagine, like we sit around the table and pick apart games. So I can only imagine when they're in those early stages and you guys are still like, tear it apart, like give us something to think through, that gamers will just sit there and do it. And I love that. That's awesome.
We'll take all of the lovingly critical feedback.
The non-loving, we don't want any of that though. We have to take that. I love that. So I'm curious, you know, thinking about wanting this game to be accessible for newer players. And we talked about how you have certain cards that never make it to the demo. Are there specific leaders that you are like, let's make sure that doesn't get into the demo, or ones that you gravitate towards? You're like, these were designed as like our starting four, if you will, to make sure that this is easier for players.
Yeah, and I think that's a great way to frame it, and something that if I was going to read you the rule book, I would include that, because I feel like we didn't necessarily like say that, but when we demo, we always demo with the Agrarian Lord, the Druid Lord, the Warlord, and then if it's a fourth player, we kind of rotate with the Sorcerer or the Trade Queen. Now, that fourth one is a little bit harder just because like the Sorcerer is a variable start. So you're having a net new player having to like make a choice there. But it's fun. That's actually my favorite character to play as. The Trade Queen is not that hard in the sense that like it's a fairly like there's like a lumberyard to start, which is like fairly straightforward. But then they have this merchant, and the merchant can just be a little bit harder from a cognitive load because you get to copy other people's production. And that's just like can be overwhelming for like a newer player if they're not super familiar with this style of game, because then they're like, oh my gosh, I have to like look all around the table to see what's going on to make a decision. But I think that the Agrarian Lord, the Druid Lord, and the Warlord are all very straightforward. Warlord's definitely a very like, you know, exactly kind of the strategy there.
This is what we're doing. Like,
the Agrarian Lord people gravitate towards, and we actually think that's like one of, if not the hardest character to win as. And that's partly because the production it starts with, it like those cards are pretty low points, and like people typically like can fall into a trap where like they just get other more basic production cards out because they're like, oh, I'm just gonna like, you know, get another quarry and get a forest, and those are okay, but there's a lot of other more powerful production that you really need to stack in there as the Agrarian Lord to have a big oomph, you know, like victory point kind of build.
In order for the Agrarian Lord to win, they in like a competitive game, they have a very specific production build, so like their strategy is like very focused. But then you have a leader like the Warden, who I do not recommend at all for a first-time play, because they can take you in, you know, there's eight different leaders, there's eight different strategies. The Warden can go in all eight, where they're just like, the world is your oyster in terms of options. They start with the cards, they start with the ability to get gold and tuck cards. And that was actually the last leader we designed as well. And I view it as the most advanced leader. And I also took it off of the solo mode. So if you play the solo mode, you'll see it's not included. And that's because I found that, you know, generally in a solo mode game, it's my understanding you're trying to get about a 50% win rate. And the Warden wins a little bit more than that when you play in solo mode.
Yeah. There's also the Spymaster, which I don't know if you all have played with that yet, but that's a really fun one. But again, it's a little bit more harder for a newer player because their ability is you get to copy anyone else's ability. So you, one, have to know what those other abilities are. And you have to seed that into your estate. So like if you are copying the assassin, like the Warlord's ability with the assassin, well, you need to have your own assassin to do that. So great one for, again, like more seasoned players who want more of that challenge. And
For the pious one is a card mining strategy.
Let's just talk about all of them.
I love it.
And so with the card mining strategy, you're going to get an overwhelming number of cards in your hand if you're playing the pious one, and figuring out which one's most important to you. That's like the challenge of the pious one. So also not a first time play leader that we put out.
That makes sense.
I love listening to you guys kind of back and forth here on what really like what was the design choice behind each person and each character. And I think that's really cool. You really, really tried to create this balance of multiple different options. Like this person does this, 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 and there's one that does everything and you have to pick. I admire that in a game design. I think that's really cool.
I want to switch a little bit to the publishing side, because we've obviously taken on another massive side of it, of not just creating a game, but also publishing the game. Was there a conversation where you were like, okay, let's put out feelers, see if it's something where we can get somebody to publish this? Or was it always, nope, this is us and we're doing it?
Yeah, I think that it definitely was always leaning towards let's publish. But I think that we kind of were considering and like did a very small scratch the surface of what does game design or what does like licensing type of situation look like. We went to Unpub Prime, which I think they've rebranded to something, but it's like the Unpub Group's little festival weekend where it's really focused on designers, you know, testing all weekend long, which is great. And then learned a lot at that weekend about like those two tracks of like, you know, if like, you know, you self-publish, like here's what this means. And if you're going to, you know, license, this is what it means. And I think we were a little naive too of like, oh, we can just do it. And like, you know, work too. I mean, you're running a small business, you know, it's sure. Like you have to incorporate, you have to figure out how to collect payments. You have to stand up a whole e-commerce site, you know, so there's a lot behind the scenes to be an actual publisher. Yeah. But I also think that we think like long term, that's going to set us up to maybe like right now, very candidly, like we are not working on it as our only thing. And that's just because it takes time to kind of build up your catalog and your brand and like connect with enough people to like know who you are so that when you launch a game, you know, you're able to do a bigger print run. Cause like it's all about from a manufacturing point of view, trying to bring your unit costs down so that way yeah. you are able to make a more affordable game for people. Cause I think that's the other balancing act of, you know, you're trying to design a game that has all these fancy bits and everything, but you're mm-hmm. also trying to have it be something that people can afford to purchase, you know?
Yeah.
And you got to make some money on it, like to pay all of our bills of like, that's good for it. Yeah.
What was the most stressful part of all that then? Like you're saying, like, was there anything that was like, man, that seems impossible to handle? Or
I'll say from my point of view, and then I'd love to hear yours.
I've got a story.
Okay. I think for me, it's like it was a little bit of like the validation of like, do people actually want this thing? Like we spent all this time and working on it. And that was probably like a little bit looking back, like, how we approached the Kickstarter was like that's like the social validation that like people actually want this thing made. A lot of publishers these days will bring a game that's basically 100% done or like 99% done to Kickstarter, and then they're producing it very quickly. We kind of, you know, had done so much work and we felt really good about it, where it was. But we didn't want to continue just throwing money into a pit. we were like, let's just pause. You know, bring it to Kickstarter and raise the capital to finish the project. And that's really what the funds were used for. Like we really like needed to finish paying for all the art. We needed to finish paying for the graphic design. We needed to manufacture the game and bring it over to the country. So that I think for me, that was like, you know, like understanding how all of that worked. And then
that's stressful.
Yeah, it was like a lot of learning. But the industry is super collaborative. So like shout out to a bunch of different, you know, other indie publishers that were ahead of us. And like, you know, we met through the process and were very, you know, helpful in educating us. Like BA Games was huge for us. Just like Sam, he's the publisher at BA Games. He sat with me on like a 2-hour Zoom call. Just sharing what does it mean to freight and fulfill your game? Like, what are all these terms? And like, how does that work?
Cool.
So yeah, it's like that, I think, was like the most stressful for me. What about you?
there's a lot of moments of just like dismay and like fear, like very specific moments too. Like we just sat down in the unpublished room and this person, you know, did not give me lovingly critical feedback and tore me apart. And like, I now need to hold my composure before I fall into like rejection dysphoria that this person hated my game. And, you know, my eyes are just like, game the trash. You're right, man. This is terrible.
Oh, no.
Like 5 days before, you know, the Kickstarter is about to end. We're funded. And we see this announcement and it's like 140% tariff.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I forget when that happened, but that was like another moment where
are we going to refund? Like, can we keep proceeding? There's just like moments like that of just like,
yeah.
And whenever those happen, it's just like pause, take a moment to process what's happening, and usually things will work themselves out. Yeah. And if they don't, you can always just, you know, just keep pushing a little bit more. There's like an Italian phrase there, like piano, piano, gradual progress. We're trying to get there.
Love that. I love that.
That's so good. You know, as both of you talk, I'm like, you know, as a podcaster, I think I can relate just a little bit because you put something out there and you're just like, I don't know if anybody wants to listen to this or not.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you just keep moving forward for sure. Ian, what you got, man? I know you're ready for another one.
Oh, well, no, I think I think one, those are things that like nobody sees. No, they just see a game. They have no idea that you like almost died emotionally trying to get the game on the market. I do think it's nice to talk about to make sure that all, you know, that loving criticism, because this is your heart and soul into something, into a design. And so, you know, we try and we try not to be overly critical, but we, you know, we have to be sometimes. But when it comes down to it, out of the whole process, what was the most enjoyable thing out of all of that too? What did you surprised you in all of this process?
I think for me, it's the community building. Like, I'm definitely more of an introvert. And I think that this is definitely an industry where it's a lot of introverts too. So it's like, yeah. And just like going to conventions and you're boothing next to another person and just the conversations that you end up having. And like, that, like, we met, you know, you, Jared, at a convention, and now we're here, yeah. Right? Like, I think it's just, like, it's such a deep community, and it's so welcoming, and I'm so happy. Like, that's, like, my number one thing about, like, I'm, like, that's my biggest, like, happiness for why we're doing this. The people we're meeting, like, how we're growing as people ourselves, and, like, trying to, like, grow a business, too, in this space. It's not like a huge moneymaker industry, but I think it's like building a product and in a space, and like all of the retail stores we've met too. Like, people are just so passionate about making the safe space. Like the third place is a concept that I hadn't really heard of until Gamma Expo this year, of like just making it like a safe space for different people. And that's what I love about it.
That's so cool. Yeah.
What about you?
I would say I'm a huge like novelty seeker, and just the whole process was all net new for us. So cool to learn and like seek out the knowledge to do something like this. And like to that point now, it's like, oh, how do we keep it going? Where, you know, we're developing another game, but it's different, but it's still like there's less novelty there, but there's like new ways to insert the novelty where, oh, like there's so many different ways you can use different materials in your game design.
Oh my gosh.
There's too many decisions we need to make. Just tell us what we should be using for this. And people are like, you need a linen finish on those cards. And we're like, that's a great
linen finish.
We're doing it.
I think that there's, as you think about like the components that games have these days, like there's so many types of components and the intentionality around what's in a game and how you're interacting with it is like another level that like we weren't thinking about as much for the first game.
So game two that we're working, which we have a group of games that we're working on, but in the estate world for game two, the bit that is a big focus is thinking about the material composition and how, well, basically what we put into the manufacturing of it.
Because both from a publishing point of view too, it's like that impacts the cost, it impacts the sustainability, it impacts also like, I'm thinking too about like space on our shelves.
Yeah. As a
thing. Right? Yeah. Like when you get a game and there's so much empty space in the box, it's like a little part of me dies because there's like so much space on my shelf that's just empty, like inside.
Fully agree with you there. Fully agree. Yeah. No, I think those are important parts that, you know, like we as consumers, we recognize and see, but it's also fine. Like that's, I would imagine that's difficult to, you know, detail each part of a production. And so do you trial different, you know, boxes or game components to try and all fit it in there? How's that process of actually getting it into the box that you want or the size that you want or, you know, all of those different features?
Yeah. Fitting it in the box was definitely, I don't even know how it just happened. Like, it just worked kind of.
We're going to be about this size. It was like, you like measured the components. I'm like, nah, it's going to work.
You got it.
And then we ended up going a little bit smaller.
No. It was the opposite. So, like, our prototype boxes were great. It all fit amazing. And then, like, we kind of added a couple things. So I was like, okay, we need to make the box, like, smidge bigger. So we did. Interestingly enough, we also had gotten feedback from retailers early on with the prototype box that they were like, this box feels a little too small for the price of what the game is and like the depth of the game. Like from a consumer point of view, like I feel like people associate bigger boxes with, you know, a bigger price point and also like game. When you pick up our game, it's definitely a heavy box, but it's not a huge box. And I do think we're part of the sustainability committee as on Gamma. And like, that's something that we're talking about as publishers and also manufacturers, which is like, how do we make games more sustainable in general? Well, like the box size and like the dead space in boxes is really important for that concept. And that trickles all the way down to like how much you're paying to freight your game, to ship your game to a customer, like all these different like levers around that. But also like, people were asking us about inserts or not. And like, I was just kind of like, I don't even know how to design an insert. But our manufacturer kind of did a basic one. And I think that was great for game, like our first game. But we've now met other people who, and even just players have like redesigned. And I'm like, how did you guys design this insert? Like, that's what So I think that like, it's just, there's a lot of like different skill sets too that like bring a project to life. And, that's just like a, that's another fun aspect, I feel like, as a small publisher is like, yes, you do have to wear a lot of hats yourself, but then finding those different partners who are really good at what they do can be really rewarding and also help accelerate and make a much better product.
I think that's a really good call out moment. Like, I am mostly a mechanic designer. You helped co-design. You also did like the vast majority of the publishing work, but that, there is that element of graphic design and how do these things, how do we print them, you know, the die lines. Those were all things that I learned from a graphic designer that we brought onto the project, which Merritt, graphic designer for this, was fantastic. And then like, I can't do art. And we have James in the UK who is also fantastic for art. So little shout outs to them. They're great.
Oh, of course. It takes a village, right? I mean, it's never one or two people. There's always so many behind the scenes that add to it. You know,
and it wasn't just the four. There's so many more.
So talking about the insert for a minute, because I remember we walked to y'all's booth and, you know, you had this pitch of like, all right, we're doing Everdell, Wingspan, and Agricola. Like, and just that was the suck in, right? And I look at the table. And I see this castle, and I immediately have this is confession session time for me because I'm sure you don't listen to the episode. I hate the tree in Everdell. I absolutely hate it.
He does so much.
It's just, it's so massive and takes up, and it's great table presence. Don't get me wrong. But then I've got to take it apart and put it back into the box, and the cardboard wears out over time or whatever. So I see this castle, and I'm like, all right, I see the size of this box, and then I see this castle. Are we taking it apart every time? And that becomes something that as a consumer goes through my head, because the last thing I want to do is take apart some of your components to put it back in the box. So I hear you guys saying it's a luck thing that it kind of all fit, but surely we thought through the castle when we're putting this box together, right?
Like, kind of.
Wow.
So yes, we, with even the prototype like version of the castle, it was fitting in the box, and that was great.
Okay.
And when we added the insert, which was kind of at the 11th hour, we were like, okay, like, you know it packs well without the insert and you can totally keep the castle together. So we can just like, you know, communicate to players, you know, if you want to keep the castle together, which a lot of people might want to, here's how to pack the box without the insert. You can just take the insert out. But then like the very first second or first, like it was like one of the first BGG forums is like someone's posting a picture of the of like the thing all packed together in the insert with the castle, and I was like, of course, like it just worked. Like, that's amazing.
Hey, meant to be.
But I think that absolutely, that was like something we really wanted to do, is like not have to take the castle apart because of the durability on that component, and also just it adds more time, and we're trying to get the game to the table as fast as possible. I do think that one minor issue that we would want to update on the castle next time is that we were trying to be intentional about letting like it work with sleeved cards.
This is our confession. Yeah, by the way.
So we don't normally sleeve cards on our games. We know a lot of players do. And so, you know, with the insert, you're like, okay, make sure it's wide enough for sleeves on the cards and everything. And Soul 2. So it's like wide enough, but I forgot that like when you sleeve cards, like the deck,
the height,
and the height doesn't fit under it with like that. So that's something in the future we're like mindful about. But you can just kind of like split the deck in half, you know, if you're sleeving.
When we did the math, we only did it for one side of the sleeve.
Dang.
There you go. So,
as I'm confessing all my sins, so I did sleeve the deck. And then I saw that error and I was like, never mind. And then I sleeved them all again. But I mean, I don't usually sleeve games unless it's something that I want to keep around forever. And so I was like, man, I want these cards to stay in pristine condition. So, but I mean, they handle well. I mean, we've played the game.
The quality components all around. Even with the cards, but the tower too, like it's just excellent there. And confession, I never take into account that card sleeves add to height ever. Ever have I ever considered that? I was like, oh yeah, it's gonna fit just fine, and then it doesn't go back in the box. So don't worry, that is a common mistake. I can't imagine having like everything fit into a box related to a game design, having that have to think about those things. There's just so much detail to think about within, you know, fitting in a box in a game design itself. And I think that's where, you know, things just falling together is really cool to see, hear that story, is that, you know, you did adjust things as you went. But I think it's really cool that, you know, sometimes things just work out, like you said earlier. And that whole process, I mean, it's just meant to be. It's meant to fit in the box as is. It's meant all the components. I think that's just such a neat aspect to the journey of this game. And I think it really does, you know, as a testament to the overall design, that it's a solid design as a game, but every detail that y'all thought through, either from the smallest, you know, token to the card itself, to the tower itself, again, it's just one in sync game design. And I think that's such a neat aspect of this, and definitely want to congratulate that on that whole experience, because that's not easy to do. I think that's really cool. So absolutely well done when it comes to all of those aspects of design.
Thank you. Sure.
Thank you.
So if a listener is thinking about designing their own game, or maybe getting into publishing, which I know there are because I've talked to people on both sides that are interested in doing that, what do you recommend? What's something that you would say, man, if I could go back and tell my former self something, this is the thing?
Yeah, I would say don't be afraid to start. I know that sounds a little cliche, but with especially game design, like, it doesn't have to be fancy. Like, I think that try out the mechanic, like write it on a piece of paper and like bring it to you. Like, I think there's more and more people who are looking to get into either game design or playtesting, and like just the hobby space is growing, and that's amazing. And so there's probably people near you who might be into that. So like, check out your local game store and see like if they already have a board game night. Like, most of the stores that we've visited are very receptive to you bringing your own like prototype in. Like, it doesn't, like, it's not like a protected space. Like, it has to be like their game. Or like, I think they're trying to create a space for community. And so that would be my tip about game design. I think about the self-publishing aspect. There's a lot of roles, like we talked about, in the publishing process. So I think you have to like understand your own strengths and skills. And I actually just was talking to like someone in my, you know, realm of friends/network on Friday, who's interested in trying to break more into the gaming industry. And I gave them this advice, which is like, think about like what kind of skill set you're trying to bring into the you know, the hobby, right? So they were more like the product design side. And I was like, see if you can partner with someone who is, you know, either indie publishing or another publisher, like do something like on the side to try it out. And like, if you like it, then grow that versus trying to 100% flip into it. And I think that's probably advice for any job if you're trying to switch industries or anything. But
yeah,
there's so many people working on this, these like different games and trying to publish and everything. So, you know, if you're a project manager, you know, even at conventions, walking around and being like, hey, I have this skill set. Are you interested or looking for any help? Like, we've had people ask us about that. And then much as I don't like Facebook, it is a really big, like, community space for the industry, I've noticed. So that's like primarily why I'm on Facebook these days, is like plugging into that. There's a bunch of different groups, like game designers, and like if you're a part of the Gamma Industry Association, there's a whole Gamma group. And so like similarly, like if you're looking, like if you have free time, or like you're like, hey, I want to spend 5 hours a week, like, you know, working on building the skill set, like you could post in there and be like, hey, is anyone looking for help here? That would be like my kind of like two pieces of advice. Do you have anything?
That's good.
A few sentences of feedback on this. Don't be afraid to do a lot of playtesting. If you're going to iterate, I would try not to iterate too much at once in between playtests, because if you make too many changes, it's going to be really hard to see what has impacted what. And then I think, like, I've seen this a few times, and I think it might be a little bit unfounded, because at least from all the publishers that I've seen, you know, there's a lot of reasons why they wouldn't do this. But I've had a few designers that have been like fearful of like, oh, like if I put my game on the table, someone's going to steal my idea. And I think as designers, we are a cork in the ocean in terms of all of the game ideas that are out there.
Yeah.
And it's a lot to polish and make a great game. So I wouldn't be afraid. And if you do have a great game, I still wouldn't be afraid, because I have not met a publisher that would do something like that. But I have heard from designers say, oh, like I'm a little bit fearful, like, you know, we're at this event, and if I put it on the table, someone might steal the idea. Like, don't worry about it. No one's going to do that. You'll get a lot of good feedback. And if a publisher likes it that much, they're going to want to sign you. They're not going to, you know, try to steal your idea.
And I also think, like, in the game design process, like, as you're playtesting, there's so many people who are going to have different opinions. You can't make everyone happy. Yeah. You know? Like, I think that's something that you just have to, recognize. And, like, someone could be telling you something that they think is, like, the best idea ever, and you're like, absolutely no. And it's like, oh, that's okay, you know?
we had another publisher's like, look at this amazing game we're about to sign. And I'm like, don't really like this game, but you know what, there's a lot of games out there that are published that I don't like. It's personal preference.
Sure.
Yeah,
there was something else that I wanted to add there, you know, maybe it was about play testing. Maybe it'll come to me.
Yeah, I think there's like a lot. Go ahead.
No, I was just gonna add, so, you know, one of the things that I hear a lot, you know, that the number gets thrown around, there's 5,000 plus new games made every year, and I can imagine that would be very intimidating as a game designer. Does that feel like, how do you navigate that?
100%. That makes me scared. But I think that there's a reason why there's so many games. And I think it's because, again, like, the hobby is growing. Like, yeah. I think people are looking for more opportunities to be screen free, to be more analog, you know, and I think it helps, you know, build that community too, of like just connecting with something, someone over a shared something, is like, it's a conversation starter. Oh, you like board games, what kind of games? And then like, maybe you end up meeting up to play a game. And so I think that there's space at the table for all kinds of games. I do think that there's a difference between like a one-time published game, right? Like there's so many games that are only ever published once.
Yeah.
And like that evergreen game, and that's hard. I think that's like, our goal is to hopefully be like more of an evergreen game where we're printing it multiple times, but that's not guaranteed, you know? Yeah, and I think that the more, the more people who can like, just, I think that like players, like I think like forums like BGG as well are also great, because it helps people see all the different games. Like, it's crazy that like, what are we right now? Like,
we are 11, like this is like out of all of the games in the system, we're like 11,000, you know, 600 something out of 31,000. And those are just the games that
are in BGG.
BGG says there's enough ratings that we can rank it.
Yeah.
Because there are more pages than there are. Like, there's probably twice the amount of pages of unranked games as there are ranked games.
I don't know.
I think you need at least like 30 ratings. Sometimes they'll give you a ranking before that. Mm-hmm. It's very rare. But yeah, there's a lot of games out there, which I do have another comment on the ocean games, but I just remembered my piece of advice. And this was something we were afraid of early on. I didn't like asking people for email signups, Mm-hmm. Whether someone's going to go and self-publish or license the game, asking people for their email if they're interested in it is valuable in either direction. Because then you're going mm-hmm. to a peer and you're saying, look, I have this list of however many people that are interested in my game and that have signed up. Or if you self-publish, well, now you have an early audience. There were a couple early moments where we weren't collecting that. And if I could go back, I'd be having the sign-up sheet out.
Yeah. Get your QR code done. Yeah. Like if you have a prototype, get a QR code with a Google form.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And then
that's
sometimes good. I hear this when I'm playtesting a game where this goes to the issue of like, oh, there's 3,000 plus or minus 1,000 to 2,000 games that get published a year. There's so many games that get published this year, or I'll hear like someone just play tested a designer's game and it's like, it's just like this game that, they've played previously. And that actually makes me worry less about the potential success for that game that other designer made, because if it's reminding them of a game that maybe is successful, like that is a signal where there's probably other games like that game that might do well.
Yeah.
It's very hard to make something novel and unique. And if you're making it, like, I'm trying to think, like, there's like a whole set of games that are set collection. And they all, like, there's a lot of set collection games out
yes.
there. And they
yes.
all do well. And there's like that formula works.
Mm.
So that's where like that concept of like, don't be afraid that you're designing a set collection game. There's a reason why set collection games do well, because people, they want, there's an audience for that.
Yeah, for sure.
No, that's very good. I mean, I experienced, not to keep coming back to Estate, because, I mean, but I had that experience because Everdell was fine. Ian showed me Everdell, and I was like, all right, this is fine. I get why we have 1,001 games now with cute woodland creatures, because it sells, and it does great, and I get that. But the fantasy theme, the lore behind it, like, that just spoke to me a lot better. And to have elements from that game, but it still be its own thing, where I'm like, yeah, I could make the argument this is like Everdell, but also it does this and this differently. I think that's your sweet spot, because we are kind of out of that golden age of all new innovation. And now it's this time of how do we get these mechanics to really sing together?
A lot of the best new games will probably be like orchestrations of a lot of the, they just work really well together. That's a good way of putting it.
Well, and I think tying it back to the components as we were talking about that, like that is a huge top of mind thing for, I think, a lot of players. And like, we kind of have this thing in the industry of like, you have your deluxe game versus like your standard game.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm seeing this a little bit trend-wise, where like, I almost think people are going to start just making the version of the game that has the best components, and people will just buy that. Right. And I think some retail stores have just like, because we had now retail stores only really carry our standard edition. We only have a very small amount of deluxe left. But early on, if they backed us on Kickstarter and supported us early, like retail stores could buy deluxe. And it was really interesting to see like some stores bought the deluxe game and other stores didn't. And it's partly just like their audience. They know their gamer audience in the store is either going to want, one version or the other. But I think that we've started to see like even like Flock Together. I don't know if you guys have played that game, but I don't think they did like a deluxe game. They just did like, this is the game. This is how we want it. And like kind of like originally that was our approach. But like, again, like learning how it all worked, like it just seemed like everyone on Kickstarter does like deluxe versus not. And like, that's something that, like, we're trying to figure out as we move forward as a company is, like, do we want to continue doing that, or do we just want to make the game the game?
That's very interesting. I hadn't thought about that piece, but, like, yeah, I'll say that. Because I looked at Flock Together because of the kids. I've got 3 girls, which you met. And, I was like, okay, like I like where this is at. I love the components of it. But the flip side of that is because there's only the deluxe option, I kind of backed away from it because I was like, well, do I want to spend that much money on a kid's game? If I had a standard version, I would be much more intrigued to try it out.
Yeah.
So you're going to have, it's back to what you were talking about before of this, like, you can't please everybody. And so I don't envy your position of having to figure out like what the majority of the market wants in that regard.
Yeah, I think I well, I don't have any kids yet, but on the way. And yeah, and but I personally like, you know, vamped up you know, components. Not to the extent that it's going to cost me $300 on Kickstarter. So, but like I do like some nice components in specific areas, and I think you guys mentioned that as well. Like that attention to detail, and I think just choosing which components you want to be important to the game and bringing that quality there, you know, what is that like, you know, making sure in this game in particular, what was something that I want this game component to be really well, you know, either designed and component quality. What was the one thing that you guys really wanted to focus on as far as components that was like, I want to take advantage of this being a really good quality?
Dual layer boards. Like that was not negotiable for us. Like
nice.
People, and they like come up to the booth and stuff and like pick it up. They're like, ooh, wow, like is this in the deluxe? And we're like, no, that's just the standard. And awesome. I think that speaks to how the game plays. These cubes that are on it are really important. Yeah. We don't want those to slide around. Like I always share that we had, you know, friends in college who had cats, and the cats would come on the table and then like
they would, you
know,
yes,
fall down and like our, yep, stuff move around. So like we all know that, like, you know, we're playing in a physical environment. So like that was just something. And then I also think like the concept of all eight leaders, we didn't want to gatekeep that either. So like we were like, okay, the base game has eight leaders in it, has these dual layer boards. It's going to cost us a little bit more. And that's why our standard game is like a little bit on that upper edge of like the medium weight price point. But I think that is a material, you know, impact to how the game feels and plays.
Yeah,
for sure.
I think, no, I mean, I think there, that was a good choice. Things,
yes, that is a non-negotiable for sure. I mean, dual layer is, it's everything.
Like I Terraforming Mars under the, you know, gun or whatever. But I can't believe the level of quality of those components in the base game. Like Devin got it for his birthday this year. And
we'd only played on like premium.
Like we had played our friends' versions of the game and everything. Yeah,
exactly.
But we didn't, decked out. We like, I like, I was just like, I didn't, I was like shocked like at what like the $70 base game came with. And it was like, okay, well, we automatically have to like upgrade these player maps.
Gotta get the yeah, well, you know, it is essential.
It's wild too, because so I love Terraforming Mars, before I riff on it here, but
yeah,
when it came out at Gen Con, I went and looked at it knowing the price point already, and I was like, no way, that can't possibly be what I'm buying. And so there is something to components that really draws people in. So I don't know. It's a delicate balance. Like I think Flock Together is a high end extreme of one end. But then Terraforming Mars is almost the other end, right? Where I don't know where the $70 is going. But
it's, all those cards.
It's a good game. So.
Plastic cubes and tiles. But no, I think that is interesting. You know, as you've mentioned too, like there has been a shift, and I think that is something to recognize. And especially if you're producing games, I think that's something you have to be paying attention to. Like Terraforming Mars came out in like 2016. So like, I mean, that's a whole other era of gaming that is different. And yeah, you know, could they have made changes? Absolutely. But, you know, at looking back, I mean, 2016 compared to now, components is, I think, a much bigger part of this whole experience when you buy a game. And so that is something to be watching out for, because it has changed. Like every 5 to 10 years, there's something that changes within the hobby. And I think it's cool to recognize, but it is something that you do have to be paying attention to. So I think it's really cool.
And I think it's so fascinating because, from a go-to-market point of view, like people are working on games now that are not going to be in the market until like 2 or 3 years from now.
You know? Yeah. Yeah.
How, and that's something we're trying to figure out, is like, how can we accelerate the cycle, you know? But it's just like, back to your point, Jared, like so many games come out every year. It's like, so just keep a pulse on what's happening and what people want. People are liking to play.
Yeah. For absolutely.
Sure. So, we're coming up on an hour and a half, so I want to make sure that we kind of wrap things up here. I had two things left. One, if it's all under wraps, all good. But is there anything you want to pitch about what's upcoming before we get out of here? And then I have a couple of smaller personal rapid fire questions for you.
Yeah. Do you want me to share about that? Or do you want to share?
Do you have like, you want to do the spoiler? What's the spoiler?
Well, ooh, I mean,
we love spoilers, so we want to do that.
So yeah, I think that like, as we talk about the theme of a state and the world and the war and everything, the next game that we're tracking towards bringing to market is The Great War, as we were originally pitching it, but we're thinking about calling it The Realm Wars to be like kind of thematic.
And so cool.
Also trying to like not be falling into the bucket of like World War One, to kind of like the war people kind of associate that. So I think we really want to try to engage with our audience of players, especially all the new players that are experiencing a state raise the realm and maybe weren't on our email list. So we're trying to encourage people to join the email list to hear about like different lore drops that we're going to be doing this year as we build up to the Kickstarter campaign. So we're going to be dropping little nuggets of like the story along the way. And we also have this map that we've been working on. So at some point, we're going to do a big reveal of the map and kind of talk about, you know, what's going on there. But the high level pitch of the Realm Wars is that you are taking on the role of these nobles again, and you're actually fighting out the war, and you have, you know, troops, and there's area control on the map. And how, like, when you're discovering different parts of the map, it's like this lore book that you then can choose a scenario from, and that's going to impact like what happens on that spot in the map. So it's like a little bit of these like Twilight Imperium style area control, a little bit of like RPG, like get into like, you know, reading a narrative about something.
That sounds awesome.
I'm so pumped.
That sounds awesome. Yeah.
So pumped.
Have an old world map. And I think one of the things I'm really excited about from a design perspective is when you first set things up, it's got like that really old world feel, and you know, have the lore book, you've got
it's like
the
monochromatic.
And then as players are interacting with the map, you're going to be bringing color and like basically the building the reality of the world where, you know, you're building things out, you're encountering these scenarios, it's going to change what's on the map. And so the map, my hope is that it'll slowly pop with color. Obviously right now it's a lot of hand-drawn sketches and we don't have all yet, but we're working through it, James, so it's exciting.
That's like I was thinking when we were discussing earlier, I was like, man, I wonder what like that do they want to do like an escape game level of like mystery behind a game? And I feel like we're getting really close to what I was like gonna ask you. That's crazy. I was like foreshadowing, but I think it's so cool to have like when you talk about games and you think of games that have this experience, is that something that you're looking for here too, of this overall experience of, you know, pulling something out of the box and there's something else that you need to play with? Is that anything like that come about when you're designing stuff like this, of like there's this experience level too that's like physical that you're trying to replicate?
I mean, it was my dream where we talked about this for just game one, instead of having it come in the plastic like shrink wrap, which like retail stores really, a lot of them want that because it shows, you know, this is mint. We put it in some sort of like realm packaging wrap that's like, you know, like the stamp on it, and it like, this is
oh man,
from, you know, this is a package from the realm that's just arrived. Like there's that, yes, there is definitely that. I want that vibe and that experience.
I love it.
That's what we're trying to build.
Yeah,
man.
Time to get there.
Absolutely. Yeah, hey, all I know is all I'm about it. So if it happens, I will remember this moment because I want it.
It's very exciting. I love the vision. I mean, I know I've said it multiple times, but I'm just really excited to see what y'all put together. So that's good. All right. Ian, do you have anything else? Do you want to ask before we get to the most important part where we don't talk about their game at all anymore and we just talk about them?
You know, no, we've talked about so much. And again, I think, you know, congratulating y'all on such a cool game experience, but also like you've walked through so many aspects of the design, from the game design, but also the production and all that. I think that's so cool. And, you know, obviously sharing your story, I think is important for people to reach out. And I think it's so cool. And then when it comes down to the actual game and this world that you're building, again, I think this is such a neat aspect to create, like we said, this experience. And whenever I play games, you know, I want an experience, and you know, even with my family or whatever, I think that, you guys focusing on that is so essential. And I think it's really cool, and it makes me, you know, happy, and I don't know, just look forward to what the future of gaming is, especially in your company. But like, as we move into the gaming world, I think that's so cool, because gaming is about experiences with other people. And I think that's so neat. So I just want to congratulate you again before we you do these rapid fire questions that are anyway, continue on, Jared.
So we have to know, are you a snack or no snack family at the game table?
Snacks, but I feel like in a like they have to be like, you know, neat snacks, like not like your fingers get all messy, you know?
I got you.
Like napkins.
Napkins are
but
very important.
Totally like snacks happening during game night for sure. Yeah.
Okay. Very good. Do y'all have a snack of choice?
Oh, popcorn. I mean, we like to like make popcorn. Like we kind of like air pop it in the microwave. Nice. We have this little thing and then we put spices on it. So it's kind of our own spice mixes.
Ooh. All right. Now I'm intrigued. We're going down the well. What spices are our go-to for popcorn?
Okay. So
you pick one first.
I like making like a mix. Have you ever heard of nutritional yeast or nooch? It's like this like, yeah. Okay, so like I'll put like that on with a little bit of roasted garlic powder and then a little bit of salt and a little bit of smoked paprika.
And I'm keeping it simple. Wow. Taco seasoning.
Nice.
You guys are invited the next game night.
Yeah, that's popcorn. I love it. I love it. Yeah. Wow.
Awesome. Yeah. All right. What is a game that is massively underrated in your mind that needs way more love than it gets?
He's looking at his game collection.
Yeah, I watched him. Yeah.
It's just like what, like
I feel styles. Like, yeah, like I feel like I really like Planet Unknown. That's like a recent fan favorite of mine, and like it has like the asymmetry aspects of like how I like having different styles in games, and then just like the Tetris style is like a nice sweet spot for me. I love Tetris, grew up playing it. And so I feel like that hits two different, you know, dopamine hits for me. It's like
nice
pieces and then like the asymmetry of like I can do cool stuff that like they like, you know, so other people can't do.
Mistwind, maybe.
Okay.
It's a logistics game, but it has so much more going on with it. Hmm. So
nice.
Nice.
Very nice. I love that. I haven't played Mistwind, but Planet Unknown is a good choice. I am very familiar. Love that one. All right. I'm going to give an example after this question because I'm not sure if it's well worded. But do either of you have habits or patterns that you see the other one do at the table? So like one for us, whenever we get a new game to the table, which happens all the time in podcasting, Anna always wins first. I can't ever win on the first go around. It's inevitable. But over time, I get the higher win rate. So do y'all have little quirks like that?
If Catherine starts to say, I'm not doing well, like, oh, this isn't a good game, she is probably going to win.
That's hilarious.
Catherine, Ian's the same way. Every time he gets like that, we're like, Ian, shut up.
That's hilarious. Yeah, that's mine.
I mean, I feel like Devin is just like so competitive, like always. So like you can't sleep on him. Like he's just like always going for the win no matter what. Even with like friends who are like, you know, you're introducing to a game, he's gonna crush them. Like it doesn't matter.
Oh no.
Devin, that's bad hosting, man. I'm just gonna go ahead and tell you.
But it's okay.
Okay, so we'll lead into the last one. The most important question: who has the higher win rate between the two of you? Roughly. I mean, obviously no one's tracking every play, but well, some people are, I guess, but.
You're asking more broadly or with a state?
More broadly. Yeah.
I think it's game dependent. Like photosynthesis. I have never won.
Oh.
I think, yeah. Like if you think about like the types of games, like, yeah, Devin is definitely that like crunchy game, like likes to really like plan out everything. I think I do better with games that are either like spatial awareness or sometimes like the more like adaptable, like, you know, you're having a lot of variance and like I do really well, like just like being adaptive and kind of the like you're very much like
if there's an economy, like a resource management,
yeah,
like, I can usually kind of game theory optimize it.
Yeah,
like
for sure.
Forges of Ravenshire, I like optimized perfectly and had zero resources left. Like,
yeah.
Granted, if we play that a few more times, I think you'll probably start beating me.
But I will say for like one of our OG games, like especially for two player for us was Splendor. And we got so good at it that it was like whoever started the game, I think, would always win.
Yeah.
Like just because it was like you can really, especially in a two player game, like unless you're making a mistake, like it's like there's just kind of a clear like ladder of like, all right, this is the best card. These are the best things to pick. So we recently got Splendor Duel to try to like circumvent that. We kind of stopped playing Splendor because of that two player at least. But
yeah.
Yeah.
What about in Estate itself? Who wins the most?
I think I do. I think that lends itself again to like that the air events are like variants and like I'm really good at adapting and like kind of optimizing what I'm seeing in the moment.
If I could plan to the end of the game, I might be able to win because I have to plan that to event. Yeah.
Right.
Scythe, Catherine mentioned, oh, like I was just getting my point engine going and someone gets a star.
That's it.
There it is.
Yeah, I felt that. I felt that earlier.
Yeah.
That's funny. No, that's great. I love it. Okay, well, we'll finish with this. Where can people find you? You know, how do they follow along? We'll add the link that you mentioned about the email list for sure, but where else can they look for you?
Yeah, so you can find everything on our website at grodgames.com, which is G-R-O-D, games.com. And then we're on all the socials. So you can find Grod Games on Instagram, YouTube. We're on TikTok as well. And then we do have an Estate Raise the Realm specific Instagram channel. And that's where you can find more things like specific about Estate itself. So like strategy videos, like we're trying to release like different strategy guides for each of the leaders and like talking about just different fun, like different nuances of, you know, things that we think are interesting from a playing point of view. Whereas if you're trying to follow like more of what are we doing as a publishing company? What's the new stuff coming out? Like that's more like the Grod Games Instagram and totally nice. Email list, which we've been a little delinquent on, but I'm like putting the stake in the sand publicly here that we're doing a monthly email now just to kind of keep like, you know, our fans and the Grod Guild, as we call them, all up to date on all the cool things that we're working on and bring them along the journey, because I think that's part of the fun of it, especially with indie design and games, is like having a voice like of what the game ends up being. Like we're always listening to players and here in Boston now a little bit more permanently. We didn't really touch on that, but we're super excited to plug into the Boston, you know, gaming community. And like as we have the opportunity to travel again, like we love, like Devin was just in Nashville last week and kind of, what was that, a game cafe story?
Yeah, we
like
met up with a bunch of folks at a game cafe and we did a teach of three different tables.
Yeah.
Nice.
So yeah, so I think that like we're we just want to keep building the community. And so like reach out to us if you have ideas for how you want to do that with us. And you can, you know, join the Grod Guild on our Discord or our email newsletter.
That's awesome. Which did you go to the one over in East Nashville?
This was Nashville. Did you?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
Was it called Game Point Cafe?
No, it was not. It was a new one. I don't know off the top of my head. Let me look it up.
We're based in Nashville. That's why I was asking.
Yeah.
You know Chance? He's another leader. I'll share it after the call.
Yeah, that sounds fine. All right.
Yeah,
very good.
Not a problem. It was more curiosity.
Yeah, sorry. I totally went off. I was ready to close this out. And then I was like, wait a minute. What's going on?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I also really need to go to the bathroom. So I'm going to step away.
No. Absolutely awesome. Allowed.
All right, well, as Devin steps away, Catherine, thank you both for stepping in and joining us for tonight. It was a great talk and loved all the insights. To our audience, all the links are in the description. Please check that out so you can see all the places that Grod Games is found, and please feel free to reach out to us with your thoughts and comments. Until next time, may your dice rolls and your card draws be blessed, and your experiences at the table be ones to remember forever.
Absolutely. And make sure you go to the bathroom.
Thanks, Ian.
Don't hold it.